Well, I'm normally casual anyway because I'm a cowboy from Texas, but I'm really casual this morning with a broken leg. So forgive me for that casualness. Let me start us out with a Bible verse that I think you'll recognize. It's a Bible verse that comes, let's see, I have to get it going. Here it is in Proverbs 10:22. Proverbs 10:22 says, "The blessing of the Lord makes rich and he adds no sorrow to it." And what you find is that God's blessings are things that enrich your life. But sometimes the things that most enrich your life are the things you don't even notice. And I really learned this from a founding father named Benjamin Rush. He's one of the guys who signed the Declaration of Independence. John Adams actually said he's one of the three most notable founding fathers, but we'll never study him in school today because he's way too Christian. He's an evangelical. He started the Sunday school movement. He started the first Bible society in America. He also started the first abolition society, trained the first black physicians to help start the first black denomination. I mean, the guy did all sorts of just amazing things. And at our organization, we own about 100,000 documents from before 1812. So I have thousands of the handwritten documents of George Washington and Jefferson Adams, all these guys. And I've got so many of his original documents as well. And among what we own, prayer journals, because as he would read through the Bible, he would read through and be praying, and the Lord would show him something he'd write out in the journals. And so as you read his prayer journals and you see what the Lord's showing him, and you read his memoirs and you read his diary, it's interesting. And one of the things that really stood out to me was how he tried to be a very grateful Christian. He tried to thank God for blessings he saw in his life, and he would stop and thank God for those. And I was reading them one time, and there was one that just kind of stood out to me because he's going through the list. I'm thanking God for this, that. He said, "And I thank God for all the times I have not fallen downstairs." Really? And I started thinking about that, and it's like, you know, how many thousands of times do we go up and downstairs and don't fall and we never notice it? Now, if you fall and notice it, that's not a blessing. But think how many times you didn't fall, and that's a blessing you didn't fall. It's like when you drive a car, if you go out and go to the grocery store, come back, didn't have a wreck, you don't think about it. And if you had a wreck, you notice that. That's not what you want, is to notice. And it's the things that you don't notice. You just take for granted that some of the biggest blessings, your health until you lose it, your family until something happens. And so many things that are around us day by day are some of the biggest blessings. And as I was thinking about that, particularly we as Americans experience so many blessings that we take for granted, more so than other places in the world, quite frankly. You look at what we have as Americans in the way of our form of government, the documents we have, we are one of 195 nations in the world, 194 other nations. That number goes up and down every year. Jesus said there'd be wars and rumors of wars, and they've been that way since he left, that way until he gets back. So there's always nations that are having wars and revolutions and starting up and going away. And so out of the 195 nations, we in America have things that no other nation has ever experienced in their entire duration, their entire history. For example, in our case, we have a constitution that was written in 1787 and ratified in 1788 and went to effect in 1789. So our government is still under our first constitution. Try finding another government in the world like that. I'll give you some examples of that. Look at how often governments occur for other nations throughout the world. And imagine being in nations that have revolutions or a new constitution every generation, every decade. If you're 95 years old today and you're alive in Poland, you have lived through seven constitutions in your country in your lifetime. If you're a baby boomer from South Korea, you have lived through six constitutions in your lifetime, and South Korea is considered to be a stable nation. Six constitutions, really? See, what we don't recognize is that the average length of a constitution in the world, when you look at all the constitutions, the average length is only 17 years. Well, we've had ours for 228 years. It's a little different from others. We're just so used to stability, we just kind of assume that's natural. It's not natural. Nobody else comes anywhere close to enjoying the stability we have under one form of government, one constitution for that many years. So that's a blessing. I'm not sure how often we thank God for that because we just kind of take it for granted. And it's the same way when we get into things like creativity. There's a lot of ways internationally to measure creativity, copyrights, patents, et cetera. And every year, America, now we have 4% of the world's population in America. And every year, our 4% of the world's population, when it comes to discoveries, medical discoveries and cure and technology and scientific findings and symphonies and literature and novels and you look at all the creativity every year in the world, our 4% produces more every year than the other 96% of the world combined. Now, 4% of the world's population should produce 4% of the world's whatever. Our 4% every year produces more than the other 96%. We are so surrounded with technology and discoveries and benefits, and we just kind of take them for granted because we have new stuff every year. Not in the rest of the world. The rest of the world, I mean, their 96% can't even come up with what our 4% comes up with. And it's the same thing with our prosperity. Our 4% of the world's population produces 25% of the world's gross domestic product. And we don't produce more in America because we have more. That's just not true. There's so many nations with greater natural resources than we have. Cowboy from Texas, that puts me in the agriculture industry. So in the agriculture side, agriculture is only 1% of America's gross domestic product. Not the world's, only 1% of America's. And yet, as agriculture people, our 1% of the world's gross our 1% of America's gross domestic product feeds the entire world. We're capable of feeding the entire world. And America is only 66 in the world in percentage of farmable land. So being number 66 in the world percentage of farmable land and producing only 1% of America's GDP, that's enough to feed the entire world. I mean, we take what we have and make it go further than any other nation. And we're just so used to this, we think it's natural. And it's not. What we have is very definitely the exception and not the rule. And people have known that for a long time. Alexis de Tocqueville came to America in 1831, wrote the book Democracy in America, and he's the guy who gave us the term American exceptionalism. He said, Americans, this is exceptional. I don't think any nation will be able to do what they've done. And so there are so many books that we have of foreign observers who came here and said, man, I've never seen this, no other nation. And so we've been a blessed nation. Now, what's different is that in previous generations, as you go back through old textbooks up to World War II, we openly told you that the reason that America was different, the reason we had been blessed, the reason that we were more productive, the reason that we were more creative, the reason we were more stable was because of the Bible. We openly said that in schools. And there was no hiding that. We openly said it. We don't say that anymore. We actually say just the opposite. Oh, no, no, America was created as a secular nation. Our founding fathers were secular. I mean, we're just the opposite. But it's interesting, even today, with a very secular-minded culture, it's still very easy to show and demonstrate just how much impact the Bible has on the things we do. One of the ways is just the way we talk to one another. Do you know the language we use with each other every day? There's 257 idioms, phrases, that we use on a daily basis that are quotations out of the Bible. They're Bible references. I mean, you hear these things every day. They're all Bible verses. You get by the skin of your teeth, and I'll give you my 2 cents worth, and leopard can't change his spots, and there's nothing new under the sun. Signs of the times, a thorn in the flesh, from the cradle to the grave, handwriting on the wall, a fly in the ointment. All of those are Bible verses. Every one of them is a Bible verse. And the next time you go to, I don't know, Charlottesville or Richmond or wherever, and you stop at a Lowe's or you go to a Walmart or you go to a Macy's or a McDonald's, you're going to hear somebody use one of those phrases. And when you do, you ought to stop that person and say, do you know what Bible verse you just quoted? Now, they'll be shocked. No, I don't. And they'll look at you and say, what verse was that? Problem is, we won't have a clue either. We don't know where this stuff comes from. We just, you know, it's there. And every one of these have an address. Now, if you had known the address of those idioms, those Bible idioms, 257 idioms we use, if you had known the address of those, we would praise you and say, that's remarkable. You have great Bible knowledge. Well, I can't believe how well you understand the Bible. And see, that's what we would do today is praise you for having known that was out of the Bible. I think where we are today is very well described by President John Quincy Adams this way. John Quincy Adams said, with regard to the history contained in the Bible, it's not so much praiseworthy to be acquainted with it as it is shameful to be ignorant of it. What we have in America is a complete cultural default in this generation. You see, today, if you know the Bible, we praise you. In their time, they said, time out. You didn't know they came out of the Bible? How can you call yourself an educated person, not be familiar with the greatest book in the history of the world? See, the cultural default is it was shameful not to know that stuff back then, whereas today, to know that stuff, we praise you for it because that's the exception, not the rule for people to know it. Same thing when you go to presidents like Teddy Roosevelt. And by the way, for the next several minutes, I'm going to use presidents of the United States. I do that deliberately. You'd expect me, you'd expect Pastor Steve to say good things about the Bible. What you don't expect is that in American history, for 150 years, it was the presidents of the United States who carried the water on the Bible. They were the ones all the time reminding the nation, you can't do this without the Bible. America won't be what she is without the Bible. Our institutions are based on the Bible. I mean, they were the ones telling people all the time. It wasn't preachers doing it. It was presidents doing it. Look what Teddy Roosevelt said. He said, the teachings of the Bible are so interwoven and so entwined with our civic and our social life. And by the way, notice he did not say spiritual. We knew that. He said, the Bible's so much a part of our civic and our social life. He said it would be impossible for us to figure what life would be if these teachings were removed. He said, if you take out of America what the Bible produced in our civic and social life, you wouldn't even recognize America. What's he talking about? Let's go back to our economic prosperity. Our economic prosperity is a result of the free market economic system. The free market economic system developed in America much earlier than it did in most of the rest of the world. How did it develop in America? Well, if you study American history, you find that the free market economic system was built on five Bible verses. 1 Timothy 5:8, 2 Thessalonians 3:10, Matthew 25, Luke 19, Matthew 20. Those teachings are the basis of what has produced the most sound economy in the history of the world. Now, you take our free market economic system away today, you wouldn't recognize America. We didn't have that free market system. Nobody recognized America. But how many today know that our economic system that has created so much prosperity is the result of five Bible teachings on which that economic system is built? That's what he's talking about. You wouldn't even recognize America. Same thing with our form of government. There are seven different human forms of government. The Bible illustrates all seven of those. And we chose in America the form of government most recommended by the Bible. Our founding fathers, when they wrote the Constitution, said that we had to be not a democracy. That's one of the seven forms. They said we had to be a Republican form of government, small r, Republican. The Republican form of government, in their writings, they point back to Exodus 18:21. Where the Bible says, choose out from among you leaders of tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands. Have elections. Elect local, county, state, and federal. You have Exodus 18:21, Deuteronomy 1:15-16, Deuteronomy 16:18. That's what they used to say, that's what we're going to have in America. And that wasn't going on in Europe at the time. They all had kings in Europe. We said, not in America. We're doing elections, and we're electing everything from bottom to top. That's a Republican form of government. If you take the Republican form of government out of America, you would not recognize us. But how many people knew that it came out of the Bible? See, that's what Teddy said, and that's what we used to know in previous generations, is our institutions are produced by the Bible, not just our faith. Our civic and our social life is based on the Bible. You have people like President Franklin Roosevelt. Franklin Roosevelt said this. He said, in the formative days of the Republic, the directing influence the Bible exercised on the fathers of the nation is conspicuously evident. Oh, yeah? Try finding that in a textbook today. See what any textbook says about founding fathers and see if the Bible is evident in anything it says. It's just the opposite. Oh, no, they were all deists and didn't believe in God. And they wanted a secular society. They didn't want a kid saying God at graduation. That's why they gave a separation church and state. That's the stuff we hear today. But he said, there's no way that you can do it. As a matter of fact, he continued. He said, we cannot read the history of our rise and development as a nation without reckoning with the place the Bible's occupied in shaping the advances of the Republic. There's no way you can read American history and not see what the Bible did to make America different. And by the way, it's interesting, he said, the advances of the Republic. Like any other nation, we have warts on our nose. We're made of humans, and we made plenty of mistakes. But every time we got it right in advance, it's because we were following Bible teachings. And that's what our history taught us. That's what we saw, is when we're getting it wrong, we're not following the Bible. When it's working right, it's because we're following the Bible. And let me give you an example of how this worked, because he said the fathers of the nation, and we think about the founding fathers, and certainly Ben Franklin is one of those founding fathers. We've got about 250 folks we call founding fathers, and Franklin is one of them. He's one of the five least religious founding fathers. Franklin is interesting from several viewpoints. One is that he's the first guy in American history to call for the United States of America. Way back in 1754, a long time before the Revolution, he's saying, let's not be 13 colonies, let's be one United States. It was called the Albany Plan of Union. They didn't get it done in 1754, but 22 years later, he's one of the 56 guys who signs the Declaration of Independence, which is saying, let's become an independent nation. So now we're kind of headed to what he had been dreaming about for 22 years. 7 years after that, he's one of the three guys who signs the peace treaty to end the American Revolution. Now we are becoming an independent nation. And then 4 years after that, he is sitting at the Constitutional Convention helping create the United States of America. That's what he's been dreaming about for 33 years. He's the first guy to say, let's do this. Now he gets to be there. And by the way, this is Franklin right there. You see him, the white-haired guy. He's 81 years old at this point in his life. And I know that's not particularly impressive, because the average American lifespan today is 80 years old. So he's 81, just a little more than average today. You know what the average lifespan was when they signed the Constitution in 1787? Average lifespan in America was 33 years old. So that means if you're a high school senior and you're here this morning and you had been alive back then, you would have already had your midlife crisis. I mean, once you hit 17, you're over the hill. You're downhill from there. 33 years old, average lifespan. He's 81. Now, he came into this meeting with huge expectations. This is what he's been dreaming for. It didn't go the way he had planned. About 5 weeks into this thing, it's starting to fall apart because, as it turns out, everybody came with their own agenda. You had the New York plan, the Virginia plan, you had the New Jersey plan, you had the Connecticut plan. Everybody had a plan. Of course, the guys in Connecticut didn't want the Jersey plan, and nobody in Jersey wanted the Virginia plan. Virginia didn't want the New York plan. And so what's happening is, after not getting anywhere, folks like Alexander Hamilton said, I'm out of here. I'm going back to New York. Got better things to do than waste my time here. George Mason of Virginia, same thing, going back to Gunston Hall. I'm not going to put up with this. And so as this thing is falling apart and Franklin sees that, on Thursday, June the 28th, 1787, he gave the longest speech that he gave at the Constitutional Convention. I want you to see what he told the other delegates. He said, gentlemen, he said, in this situation of this assembly, groping, as it were, in the dark to find political truth and scarce able to distinguish it when presented to us, how has it happened, sir, that we've not hitherto once thought of humbly applying to the Father of lights to illuminate our understanding? He said, in the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. And this is the room in which 11 years earlier they signed the Declaration. Franklin's one of the guys who signed the Declaration. And back then, we had one Congress. It wasn't bicameral. We didn't have a House and a Senate. We had one Congress, but they had two chaplains. And we prayed all the time. Matter of fact, by 1815, there had been 1,400 government-issued calls to prayer in America. Government was calling us to pray all the time. That's what they did back then. And he said, guys, don't you remember how we used to pray all the time in this room? He said, our prayers, sir, were heard, and they were graciously answered. He said, all of us engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of the superintending providence in our favor. And have we now forgotten this powerful friend? Or do we imagine that we no longer need his assistance? I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of man. He said, if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? We've been assured in the sacred writings that except the Lord built the house, they labor in vain that build it. He said, I firmly believe this. And I also believe that without his concurring aid, we should succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel, and we should become a reproach and a byword down to future ages. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers employing the assistance of heaven and its blessings on our deliberation be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business. Can I point out that's not bad for your least religious founding father? I mean, he's just chewed everybody else out for not praying enough. Now, here's what I want you to see. In that little speech that you just saw by Franklin there, that speech is 14 sentences long. Question I've got for you is, how many Bible verses did you just see Ben Franklin reference in that speech? The proper answer is, the number of Bible verses he referenced were 14. These are the Bible verses that Franklin just quoted from in that speech. Now, if you recognize those 14 today, we'd be praising you, saying, unbelievable, can't believe you saw this. I do this with pastors all the time. Pastors' conferences usually get two or three verses is what most pastors find. So what we have is the least religious founding father knew the Bible that well, more so than most of our evangelicals today do. See, that's the cultural default we've gone through. And by the way, to give you the rest of the story on this, after Franklin made that call for prayer at the convention, the records at the convention indicate that what happened was they took 3 days off, kind of like a cooling off period. They took 3 days off. Washington writes about it in his diary. And what they did was they went to church where they listened to patriotic orations. And while they were at church, the Reverend William Rogers had a special prayer over the Constitutional Convention. I actually own the prayer that he prayed over them. Really cool prayer. It's not like we do today. We're asked to pray to open a city council or a school board. You know, we got this little civic prayer we pray. This was really serious prayer because everybody in Philadelphia knew what was happening. The Constitutional Convention's falling apart. And so his prayer was so significant, they actually printed it on the front page of the newspaper. It takes up 3/4 of the front page of the newspaper. It is a serious prayer about God getting these guys together and healing their minds and getting them in unity and helping them to think right. And I mean, he just prays for them. And after this 3 days off of going to church and hearing patriotic orations and getting prayer, they get back together. When they get back together, delegates like Jonathan Dayton said, things were changed, different atmosphere. I mean, what was a really stupid idea last week is, that's not as bad as I thought it was. And so they have a shift in atmosphere. And what happened after 5 weeks of bickering and fighting, over the next 10 weeks, they produced the most successful constitution in the history of the world. Now, it almost fell apart. They come out with this document, and it's interesting that if you know the Bible and if you read the Constitution, you find Bible verses all throughout the Constitution. Now, the difference is back then, everybody read the Bible. We read it in schools, you studied it, and so they didn't feel like they had to tell you they were quoting the Bible because everybody recognized it. Today, we live in a culture where we have to tell you when we're quoting the Bible. You know, John 3:16 says, if you look in Matthew 6 and over at Romans 4, we have to say when we're citing the Bible. Back then, they didn't have to. And so what's interesting is today there are books like Kramnik and Moore, two professors at Cornell University, have a book called The Godless Constitution. It's a secular document. When somebody tells me the Constitution is a godless or secular document, what they've actually done is they've just told me that they are biblically illiterate. They wouldn't recognize a Bible verse if it bit them in the ankle because there's Bible verses all over it. But because they didn't put the references after the verses, we don't recognize it today. So that this history was so obvious and so evident, so well known in previous generations, that even presidents like Andrew Jackson, one of the least religious presidents, Andrew Jackson, it was a no-brainer for him. He said, the Bible is the rock on which our republic rests. And you have President Zachary Taylor. He's a war hero. His nickname was Old Rough and Ready. Look what Zachary Taylor said. He said, the Bible is the best of books. I wish it were in the hands of everyone. He said, it's indispensable to the safety and permanence of our institutions. Notice he did not say faith. He said, the Bible is indispensable to the safety and permanence of our institutions. And today you'll find that the more secular our institutions become, the less well they operate. I'll give you a quick example. Education. Education, we've made it more and more secular. I'm going to show you when that happened. But in education today, we average spending, for a student to go from first grade through 12th grade, we average spending $164,000 in tax dollars to put someone through school. And for the last 15 years, every year, 19% of our high school graduates are 100% illiterate. They cannot read a single word on their diploma. We, in 1962, America was number one in the world in literacy. We fell to number 65 in the world in literacy. We have the lowest literacy rate of any industrial nation. We have a lower literacy rate than most third world nations have. And we spend more money than anybody. That secular stuff is not working out too well. And the more secular our judiciary becomes, the less well it operates. It's no longer a court of justice. It's a court of public policy. We'll tell you what marriage is to be. We'll tell you what your conscience can believe. It's gone into a whole different phase. And the more secular economics becomes. See, all the institutions were built on biblical principles. And the more secular they become, the less well they operate. And that's what he said. The Bible's indispensable to the safety and permanence of our institutions. He continued. He said, especially should the Bible be placed in the hands of the young. It is the best school book in the world. I would that all of our people were brought up under the influence of that holy book. The best school book. He can't say that. That's unconstitutional, which is the irony. For us to do today what was constitutional for 200 years is now unconstitutional. We haven't added a new constitution. We haven't added a new First Amendment. We've still got the same thing. How come it's unconstitutional today to do what we did for 200 years? Well, the reason it was okay to do it back then was we knew our history a whole lot better. For example, if I take you back to Dr. Benjamin Rush, in addition to all the other things he did, he started five universities, three of them still go today, started academic education for women. He is called the father of public schools under the Constitution. 1787, we write the Constitution. 1788, we ratify it. And he helps ratify it, by the way. 1789, we now have the Constitution in place. Washington's our president. And he says in 1790, you know, we used to be 13 nations. Now we're one nation. What are we going to have to do in education to stay one nation? And so he wrote a piece called The Mode of Education Proper and Republic, and that's why he's called the father of public schools, because he's the guy who said, here's what our schools have to do. And the very next year, he came out with this piece, and this piece gave Bible in schools, gave a dozen reasons we would never take the Bible out of our public schools. That's what makes America a nation that stays together as we teach the Bible in our schools. I can show you so many founding fathers who said the same thing about the Bible. Important part of education was, I can show you how the Bible is a textbook, and we use this textbook. that's what we did. There was so much of that history that the court did not have difficulties like it does today. For example, in 1844, in a case called Vidal versus Girard's Executives, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a unanimous 8-0 decision, said, hey, if you're going to be a government-operated, government-funded school, you will teach the Bible. We won't fund a government school that won't teach the Bible. Really? 8-0 decision? How many of us studied about that in our American history courses? But see, that's what America used to be. The change came in 1963 in two cases called Abney and Shemp and Murray versus Curlett. In that joint decision, the U.S. Supreme Court said, hey, this thing about using the Bible in schools, we're not going to do that anymore. Now, the judges who rendered that decision, interestingly enough, said that taking the Bible out of schools was without historical or legal precedent. So the justices just said, what we're doing here has no historical or legal precedent. Then why did you do it? All you have to know why they did it is to read the decision. I've been involved in 7 cases at the U.S. Supreme Court. When we want to know why the court did what it did, we read the decision. When you read that decision, here's a statement you find in the case. It says, if portions of the New Testament were read without explanation, they could be and had been psychologically harmful to the child. We've now discovered the Bible causes brain damage. We have to save our kids from brain damage. Really? I would argue we've suffered massive brain damage since we've taken the Bible out of school. We can't even tell what the genders are anymore. We used to know as male and female. If you're not aware, today there are over 80 different genders. Facebook alone allows you to choose from 60-some-odd different genders on your profile of who you are. Bible, 4 places says, and God made them male and female, period. End of story, end of the verse. Man, we've lost our brains. For 5,500 years in human history, if you're a human being and wanted to know what gender you were, you look between your legs. Today, you look between your ears. I mean, it's crazy. We've turned this whole thing upside down in so many ways. And it's just, we've lost our brains. So with all that was there, Benjamin Rush told us exactly what would happen. Benjamin Rush said, the Bible, when not read in schools, is seldom read in any subsequent period of life. And we know this from polling now. The younger you are when you start reading the Bible, the more likely you are to have it as a life habit. Now, you can start later, but it's harder to start. If you start when you're 4, 5, and 6 like we did in schools, that was a life habit. If you start when you're 14, 15, and 16, it can be a life habit. It's just a little harder to get started. And if you're in your 20s, it's harder. And in your 30s, it's harder. And in your 40s, it can be done, and it needs to be done, but it just gets harder as you go along. And so if you don't get it early, it's harder to start when you're late. And that's where we are now. Is we're at a point in time where that we have a level of biblical illiteracy we have never before had in America. I mean, even Benjamin Franklin, the least religious founding father, I wouldn't argue he's a Christian, but he knew the Bible and he knew it really well. He quoted it and used it and called people to prayer. So where we are now, and by the way, if you look at what the Bible actually talks about as opposed to what people think it talks about, I chose every one of these topics because you've heard about them in the last 12 months in the news. The Bible addresses every single one of those topics. Most Christians today could not put a Bible verse, the rights of conscience. There's 30 verses of the New Testament alone dealing with conscience. The Bible is real clear that you should not have an estate tax. You should not have a progressive income tax. You should not have a capital gains tax. The Bible is clear that minimum wage is wrong. Most people can't tell you a Bible verse for any of that. See, that's the biblical illiteracy we've gotten into as opposed to previous generations where that we knew the Bible and applied it in economic areas and in criminal justice areas and education areas and so many areas because the Bible applies to every aspect of life. Benjamin Rush has another great quote where he says, the Bible contains more knowledge necessary to man in his present state than any book in the world. And it's that way. The Bible applies to every generation because although our technology changes, human nature does not change. And because human nature does not change, those principles work forever. You know, I was recently in Ukraine helping them do a constitution over there and was just talking to their law schools, et cetera. And I said, look, I can tell you about the American Constitution. I can tell you it's lasted long. I'll tell you why. But you shouldn't model the Constitution. What you should model is the principles in our Constitution. And then I gave them examples out of it. I said, because we're at this thing now where we say, oh, the founding fathers 200 years ago, my gosh, those guys walked everywhere and had buggies. Now we got planes, we got rockets. And 200 years ago, they were riding everything. Man, we got computers and we got technology. They don't have a clue what we were facing. Well, okay, let's do this. Let's go to Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton is the guy that 400 years ago came up with the laws of motion. It's because of the laws of motion that I, as a pilot, can fly an airplane, particularly the second law of motion. Now, I guarantee you, Newton had no thought of airplanes in his mind when he did the laws of motion, but the laws never change. They're timeless across time. They will always apply. We'll change the technology as time goes along. Boyle's Law of Gases. Robert Boyle, 400 years ago. Boyle's Law of Gases. That's why I can scuba dive today. I'll guarantee you, Boyle had no idea somebody's going to go underwater and breathe. That was never in his mind. Doesn't matter. The principles are timeless. The same thing with Kepler, the laws of planetary motion. That's why we can send a rocket to the moon or to Mars or to Jupiter, anywhere we want, because we understand. Now, he wasn't thinking rockets at the time. See, principles are timeless. They don't change. The principle of gravity is not going to change. You may not believe in gravity, but if you jump off the Empire State Building, I guarantee you will splat on the ground when you hit. It may not be what you believe in or what you agree with. The laws don't change. And that's the principles that we always had. And that's why the Bible is so timeless, because the principles don't, character doesn't change. Technology does. The human character doesn't. That's why the Bible works so well. So he says it contains more knowledge than ever stated man in his present state. Let me give you some examples. I'm going to take you back to a guy named Matthew Maury. We don't study him in textbooks anymore today. Matthew Maury, great guy. He is called the father of oceanography. Now, as the father of oceanography, he's the guy who found out that there are jet streams in the ocean, which is pretty revolutionary back then. Now, I have to point out, he's alive at the time when James Madison is giving his speeches. So we're talking a long time ago. And without satellite technology of any kind, he discovers that if you'll move about 50 miles over here, you'll get to Europe a week faster than all the other ships. And by the way, if you want to go from Europe to Africa, you get over here. And if you want to go from Africa to Australia, I mean, he finds these jet streams in the ocean. How did he do that? Well, he said he got it out of the Bible. And specifically what had happened was he was homesick one day, and he asked his family to read the Bible out loud to them. So they were reading to him out of Psalm 8. And at that point in time in Psalm 8, this is what the passage says. It says, Lord, thou madest man to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, yea, and the beasts of the field, and the fowl of the air, and the fish of the sea, and whatever passeth the sea. Read that again. Read it again. Slow down. Read. See, what jumped out at him was whatever passes through the paths of the sea. He said, I've been on sea my whole life. You see, he went to sea when he was a single-digit kid. He went as a cabin boy, and he stayed at sea because he loved it. And so he became a sailor, and he stayed longer, and he became an officer, and he stayed longer and became a ship captain. He stayed longer, and he owned his own ship, and he stayed longer and owned a bunch of ships. He just loved the sea. I mean, he was really into the sea, and I've been to sea my whole life. I've never seen a path through the sea. Read that again. If God says there's paths in the sea, there must be paths, and that's how he discovered the pathways in the sea. He's called the pathfinder of the sea, but he's the father of oceanography. But it didn't stop there. There was another verse that really shifted him, and that verse was Ecclesiastes 1:6, which says this. It says, the wind goes toward the south and turns around toward the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. Really, the wind has circuits? See, he's the guy who also discovered the jet streams in the air. Now, again, technology back in the early 1800s, we're not talking satellite technology. How did he do that? Because he found it in the Bible. And I'll point out that once he found that there were certain patterns of air moving, he could then predict weather for the first time in human history. He could say, oh, no, guys, see that pattern? You don't want to set sail this week. Wait till next week. It'll be great. And so he's called the father of naval meteorology because he was able to predict the weather based on the patterns that God put in the winds and what happened with the winds. Now, granted, this is all science stuff, physical geography stuff, and today we're told, oh, religion and science don't go together. Well, he was told that back then because, again, human nature doesn't change. The Bible is timeless. Back then, he said, I've been blamed by men of science, both in this country and in England, for quoting the Bible in confirmation of the doctrines of physical geography. The Bible, they say, was not written for scientific purposes and therefore of no authority in matters of science. Exactly what we hear today. You Christians are a bunch of Neanderthals. You're all anti-science. And so we always hear that Christianity and science are incompatible. He got that 200 years ago. His response is, they said, no, Bible and science are incompatible. He said, I beg pardon. He says, the Bible is authority for everything it touches. The Bible is true and science is true. They're both true. And when your men of science, with vain and hasty conceit, announce that a discovery disagreement between them, which is what we hear all the time today. He said, when your men of science announce a discovery disagreement between them, he says, rely on it. The fault is not with the witness or his records. It's not God's issue, but it's with the worm, the sinful human, who attempts to interpret evidence which he does not understand. He said, you just hang on. Your science will catch up with what God's teaching. And that's been the lesson of history from beginning of time. You go back and the guys who have made the most advances in science have been the guys who spent the most time in the Bible. For example, Francis Bacon is called the father of modern science. He's the guy who came up with inductive reason, the scientific process, all that. Francis Bacon wrote more on theology in the Bible than he did on science, and he's the greatest science, considered the greatest science in modern history. You also have Newton. I talked to you about Newton. He did optics and he did physics. He did the laws of motion, the laws of gravity. Newton wrote more about the Bible than he did about science. The same with Kepler, the same with Copernicus, all these other guys. The great scientific guys are the guys who spent time there. And the secular guys say, no, you're all wrong. And eventually science comes back around here. We have a daily radio program, about 300 stations across the nation. And about every 2 weeks, we'll take out the new scientific studies that are out that are coming back to where the Bible was. You know, for years they've been saying, oh no, this stuff is nuts. And now they're back over here. I mean, we did one recently where even California is admitting that they've been doing it wrong for 30 years and the Bible is actually right. California? Really? No joke? So it's moving in that, but you just give time. And he's right. He said, your scientific men will come back around to this. But there's other guys as well. You have folks like John Adams. John Adams, certainly one of the key founding fathers. And John Adams talks about what makes our government unique is that constitutional separation of powers. Other places had talked about it. Montesquieu talked about it, but nobody had done it before America did. America's the first one to have constitutional separation of powers. That's what's made us so unique. Our government's enabled to last, caused us to last long. How come they did that when no other government was doing it? He said they got out of Jeremiah 17:9. He has multiple writings talking about how that verse is what allowed them to do checks and balances on government. Then you have folks like James Kent. James Kent's called a father of American jurisprudence. He's one of the two guys who set up the American judicial system. And when they set up the judicial system, they set up the use of circuit courts. The U.S. Supreme Court is a circuit court. Back in the day, the U.S. Supreme Court justices got on horseback and they rode the circuit. Today, they still ride the circuit, but they do it electronically. But they still have circuits. So how come we went into circuit courts? Well, James Kent, father of American jurisprudence, said, well, that's what the Bible teaches. That's 1 Samuel 7:15-16. You've got people like Ben Franklin who started the healthcare system in America, started the first hospital in American history. How come he started the first hospital? Really simple. You want to go and see why he did? You walk inside the Pennsylvania hospital. On the right side of the doors you go in is the logo, and Franklin's logo is there, and in the middle of the logo is Luke 10:35. He started the first healthcare system because of the teaching that you have in Luke 10:35. Then you've got folks like Alexander Hamilton who said, you know, Exodus 31:18, he quotes that as why we have a written constitution. By the way, James Madison does the same thing. We don't have a written constitution because everybody else did. Great Britain did not have a written constitution, and to this day does not have a written constitution. Great Britain has a Bill of Rights, but no written constitution. We weren't copying everybody else. We got a written constitution. Where'd that come from? See, so many things that we have came out of the Bible, and that's why presidents used to say our institutions won't work apart from the Bible. If you're interested in this, we have what's called the Founders Bible out there, which goes through and shows you the Bible verses that were used to create education, used to create economics, and all these different things. But the problem we have today is very simply right here with this slide. The average American family owns 4.4 Bibles, but Christians, only 14% of Christians read the Bible on a daily basis. And then if you ask Christians, well, you're reading a psalm every day, and that's good, but have you ever read the Bible from Genesis through Revelation? You find only 5% of today's Christians have read the Bible from cover to cover. So you're down in single digits on those who read it from cover to cover. And so I want to close with where I started, and that's with John Quincy Adams. John Quincy Adams, he wrote so much about the Bible that they actually did a book from his writings on the Bible, and that book was for 10-year-old Americans, showing them how to read through the Bible from cover to cover every year. And you can imagine what would happen today if a president did a book to show Americans how to read through the Bible cover to cover once a year, much less 10-year-old Americans. But what happened, he was overseas and as an ambassador to Russia, and he wrote back to his 10-year-old son and said, hey, here's 11 letters, and this will show you how to read the Bible cover to cover. And Americans said, we want that for our kids. And so they took those letters and produced it into a book, and that went all over America, edition after edition after edition, to show kids how to read the Bible cover to cover. And this is what he tells the kids. He says, no book in the world deserves to be so unceasingly studied and so profoundly meditated upon as the Bible. He says, I have myself for many years made it a practice to read through the Bible once every year. And that's what we did. That's what Benjamin Rush did, and that's what John Jay did, and Roger Sherman, and Elias Boudinot, and founder after founder. We did it in school. I mean, that's what we started school with. We learned to read out of the Bible in public school. The very first year, we read it all the way through. We memorized the Bible. He said, I've done this every year. Read the Bible every year. He says, my custom is to read 4 or 5 chapters every morning immediately after I rise from bed. It employs about an hour of my time. It seems to me the most suitable manner of beginning the day. Now, here's a guy who spent 70 years in public life. He was a U.S. Senator, 17 years in the House of Representatives. He's appointed and confirmed the U.S. Supreme Court, although he turned it down. President of the United States, Secretary of State, Foreign Ambassador to 5 different nations. Guy's 70 years in public life. Every morning, first thing off, 1 hour in the Bible, 4 to 5 chapters. Now, if you've never read through the Bible from cover to cover, let me challenge you to do so, but you don't necessarily have to do what he did. You can read the Bible from cover to cover if you'll read 3.2 chapters a day, and you can actually get it on an app that while you're brushing your teeth or combing your hair or whatever, it'll read it to you. It takes about 15 minutes to cover 3.2 chapters a day. 15 minutes every morning, you can read the entire Bible cover to cover in a year. Pretty easy to do. Now, he put an hour in it because he studied. He keeps notes on it, and I've got his diaries and memoirs, and they're just loaded up with Bible verses and what the Lord showed him. So this is what he's telling the kids. He says, I've always endeavored to read it with the same spirit which I now recommend to you. 10-year-olds, listen up. This is the way I read it. This is the way you should read it. He said, I always read it with the intention and desire that it may contribute to my advance in wisdom and virtue. I do not read the Bible like it's a devotional book. I don't look to get blessed by it. I'm not looking for spiritual blessings. I'm looking for things that are practical that I can apply. I want things that will change the way I think, my wisdom. I want to find something that will change the way I act. I want my virtue different. He said, I'm looking for application, which is why you'll find courts and education and economics and foreign affairs and immigration. You'll find everything there. And that's the way they were trained to read the Bible. And that's why they could build a culture on the Bible, because it was not just a spiritual book. It was a book of life that God gave on how to live. So that's really what I'm going to challenge you to do. And so, you know, if you've never read the Bible 12 months from now, get it knocked out. Easy thing to do. But if you have, if you're one of the 5% of Americans that have read the Bible from cover to cover, you're going to like Elias Boudinot. Elias Boudinot was a founding father during the American Revolution. He's actually the president of Congress who signed the peace treaty to end the Revolution. He then is elected to the first federal Congress, where he's a framer of the Bill of Rights. He's the first attorney admitted to the U.S. Supreme Court bar. But when he's 77 years old, he founded the American Bible Society, the oldest Bible society in America. It gives out 250 million Bibles a year, started by a founding father. 77 years old, he starts the American Bible Society, and he says, I've read the Bible more than 50 times in my life. He said, and every time I read the Bible, I see things I have never seen before, which is interesting. That's why the Bible calls itself unsearchable. Doesn't matter how many times you go through it, you'll find brand new stuff every time, because it's like peeling back an onion. You get to a deeper level, and a deeper level, and a deeper level, and you'll see things, and you'll understand things. And so if you've already read it once, make this your second time. You've read it 10 times, make this your 11. You read it 50 times, make this your 51. I mean, make it a commitment to go through the Bible once every year. Get the first one knocked out, but then keep doing it. That's the book that revolutionized America. And by the way, we have a great promise from God in Joshua 1:8, where that God says, constantly think about my word every day and every night, so you'll be sure to obey it. Read my words so that you'll start putting it into practice. He says, then you'll be prosperous and successful. See, it's why America has been more prosperous and successful than other nations. Not that we didn't have faults. We sure did. We're human. We have blemishes. We did a lot of stuff wrong. But more than any other nation, we tried to apply biblical principles into every aspect of life as we saw and understood it. And that's what's made us so unique and so different. It's what'll make you unique and different. It's what'll make you prosperous and successful, make your family. It'll make your community. It'll make your local government. It'll make the federal government. I mean, that's how you get back to it, is getting in that word. But the whole thing starts with us having Bible knowledge, which is what they based it on. So again, if you haven't read the Bible from cover to cover, or if you have, do it again. Stay in there and read it as a practical book. Don't just get blessed by it. Don't just look for devotional stuff. Look for stuff that'll challenge you, the way you think and the way you act, stuff that'll shape you, and then you'll start seeing how it applies to everything going on around you. God bless you guys. Thanks for letting me share.